Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big step!
Oh, brother!
Lead Toledo, Ernest. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello, and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast at HardwickRockSystem.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me, as usual, is Rich Craich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yes, I am ready for WrestleMania, brother.
Indeed.
I don't know about you, but...
I'm ready as well, yes. We are continuing our WrestleMania series, looking at the life and career and legacy and all the good stuff about Bill Russell. And today we are going to talk about the rivalry that he had with Wilt Chamberlain. Or was it really a rivalry? It could have been a competition. It was a friendship. It was many things. And who better to discuss it with is the author of the new book, Ball Don't Lie, and a great guy to talk about basketball history with, Iago Colas. Iago, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks, guys. It's good to be here.
And I'm going to start off with something that Russell said that I think is very appropriate here. Quote, "We were never rivals. We were competitors. A rivalry means there is a victor and a vanquished. In this case, there was never a victor or a vanquished, just competitors." And you wrote a great chapter in your book, Iago, about the myth of the rivalry. And first of all, I guess before we get into the chapter itself and some of the points that you made, why don't you talk about the book a little bit at first and just let everyone know kind of what it's about and tell them that they should buy it too, because it's really good.
Okay, you should buy it.
We're good.
You can get it online from Amazon or from Temple University Press directly. I think maybe Barnes & Noble too. It's basically a book about the history of basketball by way of the stories that the culture of basketball has generated from the time of its invention up through the present day, really. And I'm particularly interested in what I call myths, which are certain stories that may contain truth, may be entirely true in some ways, but in particular convey a certain firm belief for those who adhere to those myths. And I try and look at those myths kind of with a critical eye, figuring out how they work, what kind of work they do in the culture. And then I try to also, in each chapter, which is each one's devoted to a myth, supplement those with historical information and a kind of critical perspective on the relationship between the sport and American society at a given moment. And then lastly, I try to offer kind of an alternative to each myth. Each chapter has a section that's called an invention. And in those, I try to tell a different story about the same figures or teams or event that the myth has kind of accrued to. So it's basically a way of hacking basketball as a story-generating machine.
And I think one part that I really loved, and I think it's the first line of this chapter, but I think it really encapsulates a lot of what I think we're going to do here a little bit and a lot of what stuff that Jason and I have talked about and sort of tried to get away from with this podcast, but I thought this was a really, really good line. It just set the stage for this entire chapter, which I really love. And this is a quote from that line. "A friend of mine expressed the feeling driving this chapter as an informal rhetorical question. You see a man with 31,000 points. Another has 11 rings. You think, I have to choose. What the hell is wrong with you?"
Yeah.
I love that, because that's like, I feel like Jason and I do a pretty good job of not like this guy, that guy, like let's like debate, decide and discuss and do all that. Like it can be both, like both guys are good. But I think that in particular, I thought was a really poignant thing, because that's always been my deal. Is I always, you know, it's kind of a casual fan's perspective. I don't want to say that it's only, you know, casual fans that are doing it, but it seems to be that it people are so strong in like, okay, Jordan, you know, we see it now even, yes. We're seeing a ton this year, you know, Steph Curry, you know, the Warriors versus the Bulls, who would win, you know, Steph Curry versus Michael Jordan, LeBron versus Michael Jordan, you know, and then of course this is, you know, perhaps the first one in the NBA that everybody sort of remembers. It's, you got to choose Russell or Wilt. It can't be both. It's got to be one or the other, you know, and it's just a very interesting sort of, and you tackle that throughout the chapter as well, of just sort of why do we feel as human beings like we have to choose, like,
exactly.
You just enjoy both. Like, it's okay. You could do that, but it's I think you do a pretty good job of building that up, you know, sort of deconstructing it and then sort of talking about, hey, you know, it's just kind of the way people are sometimes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I should give credit to Chris Flink for that quote, which was actually a tweet in the first place. And yeah, I really felt like it did capture especially kind of the dynamic involved. That is a sense of compulsion to choose and having first dichotomized the two, that is kind of set it up as a binary option and then feeling compelled to choose. And so I'm trying to look at what it is that makes us feel compelled, but also what it is that has made the debate such as it is fall out and get kind of constructed in the way that it typically has, where I think it's safe to say that for most people, however much they may admire Wilt Chamberlain's individual achievements, would ultimately wind up saying that Bill Russell was the better or the more important player or the one they would choose to start their team with. It's not that nobody kind of chooses Wilt, but I'm interested in the fact that it tends to fall on the Russell side, and I'm particularly interested in the way the argument is constructed to support that choice. As you say, I think that, you know, there's a way in which I also try to accept or make room for the fact that it's sports. There are winners and losers, and so there's a way in which the very game itself kind of seems to invite us to choose. But there's also other ways to look at what happens when two great individual players take the court and face off as members of teams, especially so frequently and at such high stakes kind of situations as these two men did.
Yeah, and there's, you know, the fact that Chamberlain's greatness is captured so well with the numbers. You know, he was right. Obviously the greatest scorer of his time and almost of all time. You know, he outproduced Russell on an individual level. If you go back and look at the numbers and don't really know much about the context, you would yes. say, oh, it's well, definitely. And then if you're looking at it just from a point of view of you know, who won the matchups, it's Russell, because Russell, you know, won almost his team's won almost every time in the playoffs anyway.
Yes.
And it's a little bit more of a mystery as to what it was that, you know, made Russell great. I mean, you can, you know, there's obviously stories about it. You can understand the way that he basically reinvented defense in the NBA and the way that he transformed, you know, along with a lot of other factors, helped transform the Celtics into this machine that just ran through the NBA. But there's also that, you know, with one you can see and with one it's harder to see. And right. and you address that as well. But I do think that that's kind of part of the mystery that maybe kind of keeps this sort of a fascinating story, you know, 50 or more years after, you know, after this rivalry occurred.
Absolutely. I mean, it's part of, you know, just the way you just described, I think it's excellent. You know, it taps into some very deep-seated kinds of quandaries or dilemmas that we experience just as human beings, forget basketball fans, you know, between the tangible and the intangible and the mind and the body. And, you know, we always, you know, we want to reconcile these things, but we also kind of sometimes feel them to be in tension and need to settle on one as more important or more valuable. And I think that I'm not the first to say for sure. In fact, Russell himself said it long ago, that just about every kind of debate you'd want to have about human existence, you could project onto these two players. And so I think that, you know, that's part of what drives this as well, that we don't necessarily kind of maintain a solid awareness of what it is that makes us invest in these particular kinds of arguments. The other thing I just wanted to say, one of the most striking things I discovered in doing the research for the book is that They played, what, 140-some games against one another.
Yeah, 143.
143, right. And the average margin of victory for the Celtics in those games was 2 points. So as much as the Celtics won, you know, the majority of the regular season games and so many playoff games and championships, especially, ultimately you're talking about a single field goal. And so it's interesting to me that fact, for example, gets lost, in this very oversimplified, dichotomy between individual statistics and rings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one thing that you, made a really interesting point is that, you know, if you kind of looked at, if you never seen the two side by side, based on how the two were described,
yeah,
you would see Chamberlain as like this hulking giant and Russell as, you know, this skinny, frail guy who just couldn't physically compare. And Chamberlain is obviously bigger, but Russell was, incredibly big, incredibly strong, could jump high, was skilled. I mean, he was every bit the match for Chamberlain as an individual. I mean, the only thing that Russell really couldn't do on a basketball court effectively was shoot. He did everything else. He was an effective scorer, a great passer, obviously, yes, you know, a transcendent defensive player. They were both incredibly intelligent players too.
Exactly.
So yeah, there's a tendency to kind of cast Chamberlain as this giant whose physical gifts just let him, you know, be great, but he lacked the mental fortitude that Russell had and the, you know, willingness to self-sacrifice and work hard and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's really important. And I think, I mean, I don't know if you guys want to get into this at this point or not, but in the book, you know, an important part of what I feel I kind of discover about this rivalry is how it fits into the history of race.
Absolutely.
In the NBA, and you know, they appear in the first decade after the desegregation of the NBA, and in the context of the rising civil rights movement in the country more broadly. And part of what I speculate, ultimately, I mean, I can't really prove this kind of thing, but part of what I speculate that this myth does for fans is sort of resolve or keep at bay certain anxieties that arose at that time around the rapid ascendancy of African-American players in the game, their presence, but also their transformation of the game. And there were really, at this point in the late 50s and then into the 60s, no players that embodied that more strikingly than Russell and Chamberlain, who really kind of took the game above the rim. And I think that at that moment, given the history of the game, which had for the first 50-odd years been at its kind of most recognizable institutional levels, most visible institutional levels, a white game. It was a segregated game. I think that produced a lot of anxieties for fans and journalists, and you see this in the writing at the time. And there's a way in which I think the myth of the rivalry allows those fans to, in effect, appear to accept the presence of African Americans in the league, because after all, they're choosing between two black players as to who is the best. But in another way, by kind of mapping certain qualities that had traditionally been attributed with white players and connected to some kind of ineffable essence of basketball, by mapping those onto Russell, they could, in effect, sort of safeguard those values. And Chamberlain, in the meanwhile, could get painted with all these sort of supposed attributes that were really stereotypes about black men and black athletes at the time, and honestly still to this day.
Yeah, and I think that the to this day, and of course you expound on this a ton in that chapter, which I'll obviously, of course, recommend people read to get a better, you know, idea of this. But no, it's still something that I think I know Charles Barkley in recent years has been very outspoken about that, usually during like draft, you know, around draft coverage or whatever, yeah. Or even when a lot of this, I know the one of the big times when it was coming out was before LeBron had went to Miami and won the championships. There was a lot of this idea of like, well, look at him. Why doesn't he do more? He should do more. He's this. He has all these physical gifts. And I think that was the term that Barkley really got particularly upset about is like this idea of, and it goes to Chamberlain as well. He is gifted of this monstrous man. And like what you said a little bit, where Bill Russell's this frail, small, you know, hardworking, gritty guy. And it's like, he's like 6'9" and very strong. And you get this idea where Chamberlain is this, he doesn't work hard. He's got these natural athletic gifts, but he doesn't do enough with them. He can't win because he doesn't work hard enough, or he doesn't try hard enough, or he doesn't do this, but he's got that. Like, he gets by on just pure physical, like something that didn't even, you know, he had no control over. It just was blessed upon him as the size and this, you know, strength or whatever. And then whereas Russell, like you say in the chapter a lot, you know, unfairly as well, is sort of, you know, people sort of ascribe to him to being, you know, smaller and more, you know, it required more hard work. And there's some instances where that is true, or Russell did work harder than Chamberlain at certain points. But the idea that of course, that Will Chamberlain was this like loafing, like that he just didn't care, like he didn't want to try, like he didn't work hard at his game, like that sort of stuff. It really, it gets you. But I think you do a great job in that chapter sort of breaking down how nicely and conveniently it fits into the, okay, we have, you know, black basketball players, which are just physically gifted but lazy, and then there's these guys, and they're hustlers, and they're gritty, and they're tough, and that still comes out today. But of course, like you said, it was interesting that America sort of had to choose. Oh crap, it's two black guys. Okay, we'll go with this guy because
exactly.
He's closer to what we think white players. So it's super interesting. I think you do a great job of sort of breaking it down and discussing it. Because when I was reading that, I was just nodding my head the entire time, you nailed it. So
good, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah it's really, you know, and I feel that it's, you know, part of. I mean, I know I have certain affinities, I guess, or sympathies with Chamberlain, but the truth of the matter is, I think that the myth really diminishes the accomplishments of both of them, and the abilities and the complexity of both of them. So it's really not just about trying to kind of rescue Wilt Chamberlain from stereotypes, but also about trying to recognize the complexity of Bill Russell as a player. And as a human being, I mean, as you guys have been talking about. I mean, that's
fascinating. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but we talked a little bit in our first episode about how, like, he's an okay scorer. Like, people sort of forget that, like, he was a pretty good scorer. Like, there's numbers that'll show that when he retired, he was among the best scorers in NBA. Like, but there's this idea that he just, like, never wanted to score a basket. Nope. Just let me rebound and block and steal. And, like, scored a lot. Like, he's a very good scorer,
too.
Yeah,
you get an image of him sort of either, you know, blocking a shot skillfully to a teammate to set off an outlet pass, or getting a rebound and throwing it to Cousy, and then as though he just sort of waited under the basket for the next defensive possession. But, you know, you can still see tape of him bringing the ball up on the break himself and making pretty clever, skillful, well-timed, accurate passes to teammates on the break. You know, this is a pretty amazing thing for a guy his size in an era where those skills were not encouraged in players of that size, right? This is well before any positional revolution, obviously. So, I mean, this is a very well-rounded basketball player, as was Chamberlain on the other end. I mean, a great defensive presence, a great rebounder, and a hard worker. I mean, he played more minutes per game than anybody in history. So it's... You know, it's a real selective kind of perception of their play that could lead you to the characterizations that I think kind of define the myth of the rivalry.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget that Russell had basically the ultimate in team stability when it came to, you know, remaining in Boston the entire time of his career, while almost every single other franchise in the time that they were there, they moved to a different city. Other than the Knicks, I think every other team did move. You know, where Wilt and it was playing for the same coach until he became the coach of the team, whereas Wilt, you know, didn't have the same coach for more than three seasons. His team moved. He did much less stable and supportive ownership situations. Just, you know, Russell didn't have to deal with the obstacles that Wilt had to deal with on those things. And, you know, there may be some certain things where, especially relationship with coaches, Wilt did not necessarily contribute to making that a better situation. But, you know, Russell had the genius of his day, the greatest coach of his day to lean on. And, you know, just those personalities and the personalities of the team that was built you know, by a guy who understood dynamics very well, you know, all those things obviously benefited Russell and did generally not help Wilt.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think I mean, you know, much is made sometimes of the supporting cast, and I know that Bill Simmons has a chapter in his book where he purports anyway to debunk the myth that Bill Russell had superior supporting casts. But I think actually the numbers these days, I think Neil Payne once did a piece on this at Basketball Reference, kind of saying, no, actually he did have a better supporting cast. And I think the other thing you mentioned is really important, which has to do with kind of the stability of the environment. I mean, the team environment, that is the leadership of Red Auerbach. I think that in the Undisputed Guide to Pro Basketball History, Bethlehem Scholes makes the argument or points out that Auerbach is a kind of, proto Spurs sort of general manager in that he was grooming replacement players for particular roles and positions, even while certain stars were still kind of on the roll, right? Yes. And so, you know, that gives a player like Russell really a lot of kind of, I think, security and confidence to know that he's not going to have to suddenly retool his game because he knows what parts are there and what they're going to do, and he can rely on that. And I'm not an elite basketball player, but I can imagine that would be a really important factor in contributing to the success and to the willingness to trust the coach that, you know, Chamberlain seemed to have trouble with over his career.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, their rivalry obviously, or maybe not obviously, but it did help spark the popularity of the league. It grew in size. It grew in television exposure. It grew in, you know, financially. It grew throughout the decade of the 60s. Russell versus Wilt was the defining narrative of the decade, much like Bird Magic 20 years later. And in fact, their first game was already incredibly hype. Russell had been in the league for three seasons already, and it had been a major college star at University of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Chamberlain had also been a big college star and also spent a year with the Harlem Globetrotters, who were still a major attraction sort of at the end of the period in which they were sort of a bigger attraction than even the NBA was. And in fact, one of the big reasons why integration was fairly slow in the NBA is because there was a the owners of the teams did not want to alienate Abe Saperstein, who was the owner of the Globetrotters, who played doubleheaders with NBA teams and helped bring in a lot of revenue during the early days of the NBA. It was considered basically a new beginning of basketball. The Celtics won the game 115-106. Chamberlain outscored Russell 30-22. And it was known as the Big Collision or the Battle of the Titans in the newspaper accounts of the time. Yeah. And Russell's quote basically just, you know, he touted him in their first encounter, basically was the guy who would never criticize him throughout his entire play career. He would always praise Chamberlain as just being great. Now, what a great challenge he was and what a tremendous player he was and how hard it was to play against him. And there's sort of speculation as to whether those were really Russell's feelings or whether he helped, you know, was sort of playing to perceptions by doing that, or whether, psychological play, whether it was natural. But it's interesting that up until a very key moment at the after Russell retired, which we'll get into, that basically, you know, they Russell was complimentary toward Wilt was complimentary toward Russell, and they had a pretty deep and respectful friendship. They would spend time with each other when they traveled to each other's cities. Russell would sleep at Wilt's house, which his mom always thought was kind of weird that Russell would take a nap in Wilt's house. And there was definitely a closeness between them throughout, even though they obviously had a fierce competition as players.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's important. I mean, I know somebody asked if, you know, it was a kind of on Twitter, I think somebody asked us if Russell's respectfulness and his proclamations of friendship were sort of mind games. And, you know, who knows, that may have been something he felt was effective. But I really, you know, I don't think that, let's say this, I think that if that's the case, he carried it really, really far, if that's all there is to it. And, you know, there's this, you know, famous words after Chamberlain died about being unspeakably injured by Chamberlain's death. And so, you know, I really think that, you know, these two big black men really breaking new ground in a professional sports league and being the first superstars, really, in that league, you know, shared a bond that I think goes beyond kind of competitive mind games and so forth. You know, they were in some ways very much alone, I think, in ways that probably cemented a friendship and respect. Even though, you know, there were falling outs and even though, you know, no doubt they both wanted to win their matchups very badly. So, and you can see that even kind of in interviews that they did together late in life. You know, there's a little bit of one-upsmanship going back and forth. So I know that that's part of it, but I do think they shared something quite unique. There's no doubt in my mind. And, you know, I make the, I think I cite Russell talking about it, and you mentioned it in your opener that, you know, he didn't see it as a rivalry. He saw it as a competition. And I think he had a very sophisticated understanding, Bill Russell did, of what competition really means, and or can mean in sports, a notion of it that we've kind of lost sight of today. But, you know, in at the time of basketball's invention and for most of the history of sport, sure, there are winners and losers in competition, but those are means to a different end. The point isn't just to win for the sake of winning. The point is that winning is there to spur you to excellence, physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual excellence. And I think that that's what he recognized occurred over the years of their competition, and that that's really why he was stressing that, that it's not about the vanquished and the victor, but about what together they produced over the course of a decade.
And, you know, they were as much the same, really, as they were different. I mean, yes. You know, they were, you know, they were both obviously very tall. They were black. They were proud, strong-willed, intelligent, independent. They could be aloof and difficult with their teammates. You know, even Russell famously did not like to practice. He gave Tom Heinsohn and other teammates a hard time. He was a hard guy to know in some respects. And they both were, in particular, Russell, you know, very much were part of a new generation willing to speak out about social issues.
Exactly.
You know, they were willing, you know, they were willing to kind of stand out there. And Wilt was, he was less political, but he was definitely more just, he spoke a lot just in just how he acted. And he just was, you know, he was himself, and he stood out and did what he wanted to do. And, you know, and if you don't like it, too bad. It's interesting because, you know, they can be cast very much. You talked about how kind of they're cast on these different sides of things as players, but, in terms of how they are, socially, as activists, they're actually somewhat on the opposite side. You know, Russell was kind of the first guy to really speak out about racial quotas in the NBA. Will was more along the lines of, well, you know, owners are just being practical. They need to survive, kind of thing. And Russell was more, you know, strongly aligned with the civil rights movement. And, you know, even in the later 60s with more militants isn't the right word, but stronger groups that in the late 60s Black Panthers, he was, you know, supportive of some of those groups that had gone beyond what the, you know, previous civil rights groups had advocated, whereas Chamberlain, you know, backed Nixon and was, you know, you know, that had this more of this kind of thing. So I mean, you know, it's just all to kind of say that you know, those initial perceptions of them are, you know, personally, they're very different from that, and they're all over the map, and they're people. I mean, people are all over the map in what they believe and how they act and the things that they do. So as you dig into it, there's so much more complication to it and so much more deeper things to learn about it.
Yeah, I mean, the only comment I'd make about—I think your characterization of their politics is really accurate. The only thing I would say is that, you know, from everything I've been able to read about Chamberlain, I really wound up feeling convinced that, though I disagree with him, he believed that when he was speaking out, he was speaking out in favor of things that he thought were going to be best for African Americans. In other words, he was not somebody, as far as I can tell, who ignored social issues or racial issues or believed they didn't matter, or that, you know, he, nor for that matter, that he was somehow immune to suffering from racism. I mean, I think he was aware of it, and aware of it as a social problem, and a problem that affected blacks who weren't rich and famous like him. And, you know, I think certainly looking back, and probably it was obvious at the time for that matter, you know, he formed affiliations that clearly were mistaken. But in the myth of the rivalry, those mistakes get turned into kind of moral flaws, as though they are proof of his selfishness or his individualism or his kind of prickly sensitivity. And Russell's activism is proof of his integrity. And it is proof of his integrity, but I don't think that it's fair to say that that Chamberlain was acting without regard for issues of civil rights or racial inequality in the U.S., because I've read, he thought he was acting to try to remedy those issues.
Yeah, I think you're right, for sure. Rich, do you want to go through some of the, you dug into some of the numbers. Is there anything that you want to get into?
Yeah, just real briefly here. This is kind of a great breakdown. A Basketball Reference has this as well, which made it a lot easier. Of course, I'm sure a lot of people looked up Wilt Chamberlain versus Bill Russell. So they said, you know what, we'll make a whole page about it, which is pretty good. But of course, the first fact that I actually pulled out, which Iago, you mentioned a little bit earlier, is that over the course of their 143 games they played between playoffs and regular season, Russell's team has won by roughly 2 points. So as you said, it's a very, you know, despite there being, you know, all these game sevens and all these and of course, the moments you sort of assume Russell's the winner, Chamberlain is the loser, it, you know, 2 points. It's not as big as it appeared. But 94 regular season games, Wilt averaged 29.9 points per game. Unfortunately, he carried a 37-57 record, where Bill Russell, he had 14.2 points per game, but of course he had the 57-37 advantage. The first game they ever played, we mentioned a little bit earlier, Boston won 115-106 against Wilt's Philadelphia Warriors. Wilt had 30, Russell had 22. The last matchup between the two in the regular season, Los Angeles actually won this time, Wilt Chamberlain's Los Angeles Lakers, 108 to Boston 73, and this is on March 16th, 1969. Wilt had 9 points and Russell only two, and this was of course Russell's last year, but we'll get to that in a little bit, because they do battle again in the playoffs. They have 49 total playoff games between each other. Wilt's 25.7 points per game, so a little bit down, but a record not that bad, 20-29 actually. But of course, all the game sevens and all the big big time games are all in Russell's favor. Are mostly in Russell's favor. Russell 14.9 points per game, but of course 29-20 his record. The first game they ever played, Boston won 11 to Philadelphia Warriors 105, which is ironically the same date as their final regular season game, that March 16th. So that's nice and interesting. Wilt had 42 points. Russell had 19 and fouled out, but of course his team still won. Philadelphia Warriors, they lost though, unfortunately. And then the last game the two ever played, Boston won 108 to the Lakers 106. It's a very famous game that I'm sure we'll talk about here in a moment. May 5th, 1969, Wilt Chamberlain had 18 points. Bill Russell had 6, but of course, it's famous for many, many other things. So I don't know if you want to jump into that right now.
Sure.
Well, as well, because it's a very, it's a poignant game for
sure. We'll go through the early playoff, some of the major playoff things, and then we'll kind of finish with that, because obviously it's very important to them and their relationship. In the playoffs, they played 8 playoff series. Russell's team won 7 times. 4 of the series went to game 7 in all 4 of those cases. Russell's teams won. So you know, it very easily could have been a, you know, if they even went, you know, 50-50 in those situations instead of Russell's team winning all time, that very much would change the, I think, the perception of both players, even though it would not be a significant difference. And I'm not, obviously, I do think that there is a, I mean, the Celtics just showed like an incredible ability to win over and over again in these tight situations, not just against the Warriors and 76ers and Lakers Chamberlain's teams, but also against the Hawks and against the Lakers before Chamberlain went there. So they did this over and over again to a lot of people. So it's more than luck. But, you know, when you're winning by these margins, there is certainly an element of luck that goes into that. I think that's pretty fair to say.
Yeah, I would agree with exactly what you said. I think that there's a luck play some role. I think that, you know, my sense is that, you know, winning and closing out is something that is learned also and learned through experience. And, you know, as you pointed out earlier, Russ had won two NCAA titles with San Francisco back to back. Before entering the NBA, he won a gold medal in the Olympics, and you know, he was playing with guys who knew how to close games out, and were used to doing it together and could trust one another. And I think that has as much to do with these outcomes as luck, or as some sort of, you know, choking inability of Chamberlain to win games. I mean, it's, you know, it's the I think the issue has to do more with what experience he had with that task and what resources he had around him to enable him to complete it successfully. I mean, this goes back to, you know, when he was at Kansas, sorry, and they lost to North Carolina in the NCAA title game. You know, there's something really tragic. I mean, I'm starting to sound like a Wilt partisan, and I don't want to, but there's something very tragic to me about the margin by which we could be having a really different conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So 1960 Eastern Division Finals, the Celtics won 4-2 against the Warriors. In 62, a rematch in the Eastern Division Finals, the Celtics win in seven. This is a game seven where the Boston wins 109-107 in overtime. Russell ties his own finals record with 40 rebounds, and Sam Jones hits a game winner with 2 seconds left. In the 64 finals, the Warriors have moved to San Francisco at this point. The Celtics win that one easily 4-1. In the 65 Eastern Division Finals, Wilt is now in the 76ers. The Celtics won 4-3. They won game seven. The Celtics won game seven, 110-109. This is the famous Havlicek steals the ball, where he stole the inbounds pass by Hal Greer after Russell actually had a turnover in that, in that series. The 66 Eastern Division Finals, the Celtics win 4-1 fairly easily. If I'm not mistaken, there was a pretty serious injury for the 76ers in that series. 67, the Sixers finally break through the 68-win team that was the greatest single-season team of all time at that point. Russell is gracious in defeat, visiting Chamberlain in the locker room and shaking his hand after that loss. The Sixers ended up winning the championship for Wilt's first championship in his career. The 68 Eastern Division Finals, it's another narrow one where Celtics win in seven, 100-96. But and it's the first time a team that was down 3-1 ended up winning a series. And I think the most fascinating thing to me that sort of illustrates kind of the different environments that the two were in is the game one was on April 4th, 1968, which was the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And basically the Celtics and the Sixers both had to deal with the decision of like whether, you know, they were able or willing to play the game. It was in Philadelphia. Red Auerbach, who was the GM at that point, Russell was the coach, called an emergency meeting to discuss whether the team should play. Russell didn't want to, but he feared riots if they did not. The team eventually discussed the matter and discussed it pretty like matter of factly. Like there was like Bailey Howell during that meeting was like, oh, you know, he was a reverend. Like if, you know, if Billy Graham had died, would we cancel the game? So there were what I'm trying to say is that there were the attitudes were it was open-minded environment where people could speak their mind and not fear, you know, even saying something as horrible, you know, as that. But I think in this case it's good. I mean, they were able to kind of get those feelings out. Eventually discussed the matter and decided that, you know, at that point it was fairly close to the time of game. There was a fear that riots might happen, so they decided to play. On the other side, Wilt had called Jack Ramsey, the GM, ahead of time, saying that he didn't want to play. But Ramsey basically brought up ticket sales and contractual obligations and was just, you know, like not sympathetic about it. Wilt and Russell sort of talked and both decided that, you know, it was a good idea to play. But then later, Alex Hannum, the coach, you know, didn't call a meeting. So the Sixers showed up basically around game time, finding out the Celtics had voted to play. They all had several of the players met, and at that point, basically, it was decided that it was too late to make a decision. And then everyone, you know, was was an element of disharmony where they didn't really deal with the situation. The management didn't really understand how to deal with it, and you know, it affected one team in one way and another team in another way. So I thought that was sort of an interesting. Kind of showing a parallel, not really with Russell and Chamberlain themselves, but more with just the environments that they were in.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's a great analysis. Nothing to add to that. It's a great description of how it went down and what forces were at play, I think, for the two teams. And I guess I would just say, you know, it goes back to the earlier point that y'all made about just the stability of the environments relative stability of the environments in which each of the two players was kind of not just playing basketball, but sort of just navigating life as sort of very visible African Americans at a time of conflict, tragedy, and so forth.
Yeah. And really, I mean, they, even though the Sixers had, you know, really been a successful team, it looked like they were going to be kind of the dynasty that took over after the Celtics were done. After they lost the series, you know, Chamberlain was, he wanted out, he was traded to the Lakers, and that everything sort of broke apart. Alex Hannum left, and, they slowly started to, decline. Within just a few years, they were the worst team in NBA history, up until that point. So, it really was like, it wasn't this moment itself that led the spiral downward, but the environment went from so incredibly good to so incredibly bad in 6 years. And then the 1969 finals that we referred to, the Celtics, who were at this point were all in their early to mid 30s and were definitely aging and had struggled a bit in the regular season, had the worst regular season in in Russell's career there. They were able to beat the Lakers, who were heavily favored in the series. Chamberlain famously was landed awkwardly when grabbing a rebound and came to the bench with an injured knee with about 5 minutes left. The Lakers were down 103-96, but behind their backup center Mel Counts, the Lakers cut the lead to 103-102 with 2 minutes left. Chamberlain kept informing Butch Van Bredikhoff, their coach, that he was ready to return, but they had been feuding really horribly for the entire season. The coach said, "We're doing fine without you," and Wilt never got back to the game. And then Don Nelson hits he's able to get the ball after it was deflected off of John Havlicek, and he takes a jumper from the foul line, and then it bounces off the rim and just drops in. We talked about this game seven during our game seven series last year, so you can there's more detail if you're interested in that. But so that this is the another, you know, there's four situations here, I think, where, you know, it just barely just a bounce went the Celtics' way and they were able to win a championship. And this is Russell's last game. And that's it for their at least their rivalry when it comes to their playing rivalry, we'll say.
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
And then another interesting thing kind of coming out of that is that a few months later, Russell, after he retired, he did a bunch of things. He moved out to California, kind of started to play, tried to get into acting, and got into the dating scene after a divorce. And he also did a bunch of tours of college campuses where he would just, you know, take questions from students. And then there was one that asked him about Will Chamberlain, and he, you know, was really critical of Chamberlain publicly for the first time about taking himself out of that game and saying that, you know, if he didn't have a broken leg, there was no excuse for him to get out there, and that he was a loser, and, you know, some pretty harsh things. And Russell apparently didn't know that there was a reporter there who reported on it, and then they basically didn't speak for almost two decades. They did have a bit of reconciliation toward the end of Wilt's life. But Russell did apologize to Wilt privately, and the two, you know, gained some closure there. But it took a big toll on their friendship, and, you know, both lived lives where, you know, they were basically alone for a long time. And yes. You wonder, I'm sure would have liked to have had each other.
I think
have had plenty of sense and all that, but it's sort of a sad. Thankfully, they did reconcile, but sort of a sad, situation that they had with, and they were such strongly friends during their careers, and then afterward they drifted apart because of this.
Yeah, I mean, it is sad. It's something really tragic about it. I kind of view that as that falling out as really, you know, not the I don't blame Russell for what he did. I see it more, nor do I blame Chamberlain for the Game 7 situation. But I just see it as kind of symptomatic of the incredible pressure that they were both under, really at all times. It's kind of remarkable that something like that hadn't occurred previously. And if I remember right, I'm thinking of Aram Gutsuzian's book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. So really fantastic biography. And he kind of describes these late night phone calls that they shared, in the final decade of Chamberlain's life, where, you know, almost in spite of themselves, they just needed each other. They, as you said, I mean, they needed to talk to one another. They'd been through things that nobody else really on the planet could kind of comprehend. And so, you know, they did rekindle their friendship. And I think it actually grew quite intimate in their later years, despite the fact that, you know, they weren't seeing each other regularly or anything like that, but just by way of phone calls. And I think that sort of helps explain part of the way that Russell reacted to the news of Chamberlain's death and what he said at the funeral.
So two things that I think I'd like to close with, unless anyone else has anything else. Heading back first I'll bring up, let's say that Wilt and Russell never had to deal with the opinions of sports writers or sports fans. If they could have just played basketball and enjoyed it, and we could still see it and we could still understand it, but we could, you know, they were insulated from the criticisms that they, you know, dealt with as players, you know, whether it was basketball criticism or whatever they were doing, you know, mm-hmm. I wonder how we'd view this rivalry in that context, if there wasn't just such so much invested in the fact that one got the better of the other in terms of team success.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I think it's part of what I try and do in the last section of the chapter on the rivalry in Ball Don't Lie, which is to just like look at them on the court, you know, having deconstructed the rivalry. We can't take back all the stories we've heard, but if we can set them aside briefly and just watch them play together and really see them as a unit, not only as rivals or as competitors or as individuals on opposing teams, but really almost like artistic collaborators. That's what I try to kind of emphasize, and really what I see, having done the work of trying to kind of undo some of the preconceptions that decades of storytelling about them have laid down in my mind too. And I really see there a collaboration more than anything else. I mean, it was a competition, but it's a competition that engendered a collaboration, and that collaboration had profound effects on the game of basketball. I mean, I really don't think that there is any element of the game now that can't in some way or another be traced back to them. Not directly, obviously, in some cases, but indirectly. I mean, they truly revolutionized the game together. And in the course of doing so, they revolutionized or participated in a revolution in American society and in the way in which black athletes were viewed and in the way in which black people were able to view themselves. So that's what I think we would see if and what we can still, in at least a certain way, imagine ourselves seeing or adopt as a perspective. And it's really what I hope people do when they think about these two players.
Yeah, on my end, I would sort of, you know, if we're devoid of sort of hot takes and reporters exactly. Through history, I think I the way I would sort of take it, or I think what how, you know, some people might perceive it is just that you're watching, and maybe people would appreciate more what they were seeing at the time they were seeing. Because, you know, of course, I don't know what was going on, you know, exactly at that era, what was, you know, being written and all the, everything, that's, you know, the national media and all that sort of stuff. But just knowing from my perception of how I've lived through it, it's always been, like we said, and it Yago, you mentioned it in the chapter as well. It's always been this guy versus this guy. It was very little an appreciation of how good those games were, of how exactly. good those two guys were, how good their teams were, how good it was that, or how cool it was that these guys, no matter what, it was like, ah, here we go, you and me again. Like, you know, we got a more of an appreciation of that, I think, during the Magic Bird era, where it was like, oh, cool, it's Magic Bird again. Like, that's fun. And yes, there was that element of, okay, it's Bird versus Magic, who's going to win or whatever. But I feel like there's a difference there where people just seem sort of generally happy that those guys played each other. Those guys had great games, or those guys, you know, had great performances or whatever. Whereas even now, even today, when we still talk about, you know, Wilt versus Russell, we always say it's not Wilt and Russell having these spectacular games. It's like these two battling to decide, you know, and oh, Russell beat him here. And like, and that's what I think, maybe if we didn't necessarily have that, or we could look at it differently, it would be an appreciation for, oh my God, like, what these guys were able to do in this era and how often they were able to do it against one another is just, it's incredible. And it's something that we, you know, if living in that era, I would almost cherish a little bit more. Yeah. Of just go like, oh my, you know, these are two, you know, all time. And we still to this day, you know, these are all time greats. You were watching two arguably top five, top 10, you know, whatever you want to say. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree with a top 10 for both of these guys. Like, you're seeing those guys play each other constantly. Like, that, how cool is that? Like, in this moment, you're watching these two guys and they're doing things you've never seen on a basketball court either. And I think that's another really awesome thing as well, is that what Wilt did and what Bill did, each one of them was just completely different from what anybody had seen before in the game. And you know, many of the Russell biographies that we've sort of read and leafed through in anticipation of this WrestleMania thing or whatever, talks about just how much of a culture shock it was to see what Russell was doing, you know, in terms of blocking the shot. Like, oh my God, somebody like, like, that's a revolutionary thing of like blocking. And then Chamberlain comes in and it's just this completely, you know, game breaking sort of guy and game breaking offensive talent that just completely radically altered the game. So I think that's sort of what I would, you know, if we take away the who won, you know, who won this finals and who did this, it would be that, oh my God, you know, the confluence of these two guys at the same time being as good as they were, and then the fact that they played each other all the time in big moments and big games or whatever, it's just cherish that and to sit back and sort of enjoy it versus worrying about who won or who was going to win or who was going to win a championship or who was a disappointment or who was overachieving, just sort of appreciating it a little bit more.
Absolutely.
And last thing I'll bring up is, you know, would Russell, I mean, I think Russell is basically, at least as a player, was almost universally respected and acclaimed when he retired as, you know, yeah, as a winner and as you know, a guy who put the team first and so forth. But was the contrast with Chamberlain, did that help him achieve that respect and that view? Would he have been seen as more of a menace without Wilt as a contrast? You know, would Russell just be as like, oh, this guy just, you know, it's not fair how much he dominates the game and how great he is.
Unquestionably. I mean, Jimmy Breslin wonders whether basketball can survive Wilt Chamberlain. So thank God there is somebody to defend basketball against Wilt Chamberlain. That someone is Bill Russell. If Chamberlain, you know, in this counterfactual fantasy hadn't been around, Bill Russell would be the one breaking the game.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also, you know, the fact that Russell achieved that great of success is just another of, you know, there's a benefit there because of just, you know, demonstrating once and for all that, you know, African Americans can be leaders and can, you know, and you know, are great champions and, you know, don't shrink in big moments or whatever the, you know, terrible stereotypes were at the time. I mean, and they're, you know, it may be an extra achievement because, you know, he won so much and because, you know, he was kind of immune from a lot of, he certainly was criticized for a lot of things during his time, but he may have been immune from harsher criticism just because, like, hey, he won so many times. It's like at some point you've got to raise your hands up and just say, hey, you know, he did what he did and it was amazing.
Yeah, I think that's right. But yeah, we should not underestimate, I mean, kind of understate the degree to which he was subject to a lot of criticism in his career.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, kind of really vile racism in Boston, in his own neighborhood. And that, you know, in a certain way, it was only after his retirement that the culture fully caught up with sort of what a significant human being
sure.
he was.
Yes. Yeah. I was meaning more toward the end of his career, where I think it was more by that time. I mean, he was certainly facing horrible things, but I think the tide had turned to a degree, at least more in terms of like public criticism and in media coverage and that sort of thing.
I totally agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else? Anything else you would like to bring up, Iago?
Buy ball, don't lie.
Buy ball, don't lie.
We'll have a link in the show description.
Yes, of course.
You should buy it. I definitely recommend you buy it.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys making a space for a more nuanced and appreciative discussion of these two players, because I think that's really important. Because a lot of the attitudes that underlie the myth of the rivalry, they continue to resurface. It's not like we get over it and it's done and in the past just because these players are no longer playing. So it's great to have a space in the kind of contemporary culture of the game where this kind of conversation can happen.
Well, thank you very much. And, anything else, Rich?
No, that's it for me.
All right, cool. Well, we will, continue, with our, WrestleMania series, going on for the next few weeks. So be on the lookout for more episodes. And if you are enjoying it, or even if you're not enjoying it, let us know. You can find us on Twitter or Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Our show can be found at HardwoodParoxysm.com. Also can be found on iTunes or Stitcher by searching for Over and Back. Would greatly appreciate a rating and or review, preferably a positive one, but, you know, be honest. And until next time, thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back again soon.